can, but your eyelids are transparent.
It's weird. I feel the same, but I'm not here.
You're here.
An arrogant scientist turns himself invisible and goes insane in the process. This week, we discuss useless eyebrows, Josh Brolin's 7-pack abs, and the proper injection techniques for an invisible ape. Then we find out if Hollow Man stands the test of time.
Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glutton. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Test of Time podcast, where we talk about old movies. You know, old means at least 15 years old, so, you know, not always that old. And joining me, as always, is my friend, my co-captain, former NBC page, Alan Noah.
Random title, but sure. Yes, that's me. Hello, James. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I mean, Al, that's awesome. I mean, at NBC Page, that is such a unique job that your random internship became like such a beloved character on a sitcom. So kudos to you.
I mean, it's not an internship. It's a job. I was paid, first of all. Second of all, you're talking about Kenneth the Page on 30 Rock, I assume. But it's not like that character was based on me. It's a job that existed for a very long time.
In medicine, internship just means it's like the low level one. You still get paid. What's the term unpaid internship then?
In my world, an internship is always unpaid unless it is specifically called a paid internship, which is the exception, not the rule.
And didn't all these companies wind up like losing class action after class action from these so-called unpaid interns, like when they wound up suing? And I thought there were a lot of lawsuits like this where they wound up paying a lot of money. And like the unpaid internship thing, I think they phased that out a lot.
Well, I mean, the rule always used to be that you would have to get college credit for it. So you would have to get something. I'm not really sure about the specifics of the lawsuits. I mean, I know that when I was an intern at Late Night with Conan O'Brien, I did not get paid. I don't think I got college credit. Maybe. I don't think so. I think I just did it for the experience. I think I had to like pay out of pocket for like my train ticket into Manhattan. And all I did was get people coffee and stuff like that. I mean, it kind of is a scam. But then it did lead to my Page job. So in that way, it kind of did work out exactly the way it was supposed to.
I mean, and you got to work at Saturday Night Live. I mean, you got to work during like, what was it? It was the Tina Fey era, right?
Yes. Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon were on Weekend Update. It was Will Ferrell's last season. We were just talking about Will Ferrell when we did Elf a couple weeks back. Maya Rudolph, Horatio Sanz, Chris Kattan, Anna Gasteyer, Rachel Dratch, Daryl Hammond was very funny, Tracy Morgan. It was the second half of the 2001-2002 season. So like from January through May of 2002, thereabouts.
Is that one of your favorite casts when you were there?
Like all time?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. I'm not one of those people who's like, blank years at Saturday Night Live were the good years and every other cast sucked, or it all went downhill when fill in the blank left the show, because I feel like there are so many golden ages, quote unquote, of that show. And it seems like when you talk to people about SNL, whatever they say are the quote unquote good years are the years when they first started watching the show. And I'll cop to that. You know, the cast that I grew up loving was the early to mid 90s. You know, Adam Sandler, Chris Farley, David Spade, Kevin Nealon, you know, even a few years later with Norm Macdonald. I was watching that show and I will always have a special place in my heart for that cast. But, you know, I still watch the show. I still think it's really good. I still think it's really funny and relevant. So it's a show I've been pretty consistently watching since the 90s.
It definitely has its better seasons and worse seasons, but I think there's actually a pretty steady pattern to it. And what I think happens is that there's some talent there, and there's usually talent there, but there's some veterans that can help hone that talent while that talent grows. You know, kind of a rookie that can build upon the veterans. And every once in a while, you mentioned the Sandler Chris Farley years, but famously, I think it was like 96 or so, but that entire cast was fired, everyone except basically David Spade and Tim Meadows. And then the next few years, they kind of sucked because, you know, you didn't have all those people. You didn't have Phil Hartman to just lead you in for a little bit. And, you know, then things were good when Will Ferrell was there. I think they peaked again with the Tina Fey, Sarah Palin stuff in 2008. That was another brilliant year. You know, the Amy Poehler, Tina Fey years were great. And then it was okay, but I have to say that I think this cast that we're seeing, they've been there mostly for a few years, so most of them know what they're doing. It's diverse. You know, you don't have like one African-American person playing every single minority role. You also have some of these featured people who are usually kind of in the background. They're hysterical. I think some of these guys like Bowen Yang, he's fantastic. Chloe Fineman, mm-hmm. She's great. This cast is fantastic. I laugh almost every episode. There have been some fantastic sketches this year. They're so funny.
Yeah, they're doing really good work. And I think it is fair to say that sometimes those sketches at the very end of the show aren't always the best. And okay, that's fine. But the cold opens are usually good. The first few sketches, the tape segments are funny. Weekend Update is always good for a few laughs. I'm definitely still enjoying the show. I think it's, I mean, look, it's got legs. You know, this show has been around forever. It's been written off as dead a million times, but it just hangs in there.
You're watching movie stars right now. I mean, you know Kate McKinnon's going to have a long career after this. And, you know, I'm not sure which guy, maybe Beck Bennett, one of these guys is going to land a fantastic father figure role on you know, a sitcom. And it's a kind of cast that I'm not sure who's going to be a star out of it, but there's going to be a lot of stars. I really can't figure out what's going to happen to Pete Davidson, though. I mean, in 20 years, he's either going to be a completely different star, maybe even touched an Oscar, close to an Oscar at one point, or he's going to be nothing.
I think he's funny. I enjoy him on the show, so I don't know. We'll see. But let's move on to the movie that we're going to talk about today, Hollow Man, which is another Invisible Man movie. We did 1933's The Invisible Man last week, and I was sort of thinking like, oh, maybe we'll do a trilogy like we did with Robin Hood, because there's been like a million movies about invisible men, invisible people. And I was looking it up on Wikipedia, and really the only one that kind of grabbed me was Hollow Man. And so we're only doing two. A duology instead of a trilogy. I remember seeing this movie once before, but it had definitely been probably 20 years since I've seen it.
Yeah, I saw this in the theater. You know, I was actually surprised when you want to pick another, you know, quote unquote modern film to, you know, to counter the 1933 Invisible Man. I thought you were going to pick the Chevy Chase film, Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
I saw that one on my Wikipedia search, but I don't know it. I never saw it. And I don't know. I was just like, meh. For whatever reason, that one didn't grab me. Listeners, if you think we really should watch Memoirs of an Invisible Man, tweet at us, Facebook, Instagram, let us know, and we'll put that on the list. But for now, it felt like we could do like a very old movie from 1933 and then a more modern one from 2000, and that should cover us for Invisible Men for a while, at least.
Oh, absolutely. I think we're good there. And, you know, I know exactly why you saw this once and I saw this once. You probably saw this in the theater, right?
Maybe.
It's from director Paul Verhoeven, and I might be mispronouncing his name. I apologize. Someone please tell me if they know how to say it correctly. Because I, as you know, Al, I never mispronounce any words. Isn't that correct?
That is literally the opposite of the truth.
And it's literally in our theme song.
But, yes, really.
But anyway, this director, I mean, he is capable of making brilliant films that are so much fun and so visually beautiful. He made RoboCop, he directed Total Recall, he directed Starship Troopers, and then again, he also directed Showgirls, and he directed today's movie, Hollow Man. Now, one thing that all of his films, I'm not including Showgirls because it didn't have special effects, but one thing they all had in common was great special effects. You had Starship Troopers and Total Recall and RoboCop, and Hollow Man, I mean, it's the idea of, you know, invisibility, and no one had really taken this very well in the, you know, this new CGI era from the late 90s. Early 2000s. So I was excited for this.
Yeah. And for people who don't really remember the story of Hollow Man, it's about a scientist named Sebastian Cain who creates a compound that turns animals invisible. Once he figures out how to make the animals visible again, Sebastian decides to become the first human test subject. The part where he turns invisible works as planned, but unfortunately, his team isn't able to make him visible again. Sebastian becomes aggressive towards strangers and his fellow scientists, and they work to stop him before he can leave the lab and cause chaos. So this movie came out in the year 2000. Was it a big hit?
Yeah, and the stars are Kevin Bacon and Elizabeth Shue.
Elizabeth Shue has top billing.
Wasn't she nominated for an Academy Award for Leaving Las Vegas, or maybe she even won it? Or, you know, she's a big name, and Paul Verhoeven, mm-hmm. a big name. This had a $100 million budget, and definitely they put a huge amount of money in the special effects, and it opened at number one on August 4th, 2000, with $26.4 million, and it beat the $17 million debut of another film that we had recently reviewed about a bar in Manhattan run by a bunch of young women.
Coyote Ugly.
That's right.
Oh.
And the film was actually number one the following weekend. And not even Keanu Reeves' film, The Replacements, could topple this one. And it made all of its money in the beginning because it only made $73 million domestically. And that's less than a 3x multiplier of its opening weekend. It wound up making $190 million worldwide. And there were two direct-to-DVD sequels. So, you know, it started a franchise, but this film was not the sensation that I think the investors had probably wanted it to be.
I could sort of see that. When the movie begins, I was thinking of you because I know you get bored by uninteresting credits. And the credit sequence, it has like these letters sort of like floating in the ether. I think that they were trying to do something like scientific, like maybe it was supposed to be like DNA nucleotides, but then that's only four letters. So it's not that, but it's weird because these letters in this like alphabet soup kind of thing spell out the names, but then there's also text on screen that also says their names, like separate from those letters. It spells out the names twice. It's very weird.
It is weird, yes. But the film opens in a lab, beautifully shot, one of these stainless steel cages with a mouse that's crawling out of a hatch that's been released from, and suddenly it starts elevating in the air, and it's struggling, like, what the hell's going on, and suddenly you see this mouse just, like, constrict on itself and squeeze, and its head basically is chopped off. And you figure from the blood spatter, you quickly see that this is some kind of invisible cat.
Right. And then we cut to Sebastian Cain, who's played by Kevin Bacon, and he's working at home and he's trying to figure out something on his computer. His computer is like a very large monitor, separate desktop tower thing, which I certainly had. I'm sure you had and many of our listeners had back in this era.
But actually, his monitor is especially large, which back then, if you remember, like those huge monitors, there was a huge price jump between like a 21-inch monitor and then like a 30-inch monitor. And to have a monitor like he had, that was actually showing that he was a big deal.
Oh, okay. I completely missed that. But sure, I get that. And while he's trying to figure out this scientific formula, he's looking out the window and there's a beautiful woman who lives across the street, and he thinks that maybe she's going to take off her shirt in front of the window, but then she closes the shades and he's like, ah, shucks. And then he goes back to work and he's somehow able to figure out this thing, which he's calling reversion. He calls his coworker Linda, who's played by Elizabeth Shue, and it's not just a phone call. He uses the computer to do a video call, which is literally what you and I are doing right now, James. And we kind of take it for granted that this is a very easy thing to do. But it definitely seemed like they were showing off this was a thing that these characters knew how to do in the year 2000.
Back then, a video chat was a big deal. So this guy had a high-speed internet connection, probably ISDN or, you know, one of those 128K 56 direct landlines. Well, I guess it's 2000, so maybe he had a T1 line or something like that.
Sure. I remember hearing T1. I don't really know what it is, but that's okay. Sebastian tells Linda that they've cracked the code, but he sees in her apartment that there's someone in her bed. And the two of them, Sebastian and Linda, used to date, and now he's just a workaholic and he has no life, but clearly Linda has moved on. And she is seeing someone named Matt, who's played by Josh Brolin, and Matt also works with Linda and Sebastian, and their relationship is a secret. Linda doesn't want Sebastian to find out that she's seeing Matt. You know, they decide that they have to go to the lab because Sebastian says he cracked the code. And Matt's like, great, let's go. Linda's like, maybe we should take two cars. We don't want Sebastian to find out. We'll tell him at some point, but not yet.
I remember seeing this film exactly one time in the theater. And I remember thinking, oh my God, look, it's an old Bran from The Goonies. And now I'm like, oh my God, it's a young Josh Brolin. Because he's like shirtless like at least three times in this film. And usually for no reason. But oh, I guess the reason to show, 25-year-old Josh Brolin. But to me, it was Bran from The Goonies.
I really thought you were going to say it's a young Thanos. That's really where I thought you were going.
He's now known for things like Thanos. But no, I mean, now he's a very distinguished actor and he's Josh Brolin. But I'm saying back then I was like, oh, this is Bran. Like, he's still an actor.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always good to see a Goonie. You know, they never say die. So they show up from time to time. Now that Sebastian has figured out reversion, which basically means making something that's invisible visible again, they test it on this ape. They inject the ape with this serum and the ape becomes visible again. And the effects there look pretty cool. You sort of see the different layers of the ape kind of come back, you know, with like the blood and the organs and the bones and the skin and the fur and everything. It looks pretty cool.
I think the entire gorilla sequence is beautiful. I think it's really cool. I really like the element in this film that they introduce the fact that while you're invisible to the visible spectrum, you could just put on some infrared goggles and you could see the people. I think it's obvious that this is going to come into play later in the film, but I think it's a very cool way to really introduce this. I think the special effects are very cool here. I really like the revisualization sequence. I think every time I see some really cool CGI anatomy, I go, how come they haven't updated a film like Fantastic Voyage? And we talked about this with Innerspace. Like, it seems obvious to me to do some kind of anatomy film because CGI has advanced so much. But I think this entire scene was awesome. But one thing I thought was very weird was that they took one of these, these injection guns that you always see in movies, and they find the vein in this gorilla, and they inject a large bore needle directly into a vein. That is such a weird thing to do. You would just put an IV in there so that you know you actually have access to this vein. It seems to be a very poor choice medically.
I will certainly keep that in mind the next time I'm doing medical experiments on an ape.
On an invisible ape? Well, actually, or a visible ape. Even especially a visible ape.
Okay.
No, I'm going to correct that. Especially an invisible ape.
Good to know. Good life advice. Thank you, James. So the experiment was a success, and they go to their government bosses. Apparently they have like a Pentagon contract, and Sebastian says that he needs more time, that he hasn't got it quite right yet. And Linda and Matt are there like, why are you lying to the Pentagon people? You don't do that. But he says that he doesn't want them to know yet. He wants to do the human trial himself and not let the government know, because they'll take over, which is obviously stupid, but is necessary for the plot of the movie. I did just think it was weird that when they're watching the video of the gorilla coming back, it's like a film strip. There's like that film sound effect and like the little flicker of like the projector coming from like the back of the room. I'm like, I'm sorry. The Pentagon in the year 2000 has better video capabilities than film strips. Even if it was a VHS, it's got to be better than film.
But I mean, I think it's interesting that Sebastian decides that he is going to lie to the government about his progress. And I actually thought I misheard him at first. And then I actually thought, this is pretty interesting. He's lying to the army. I did not remember much of this film at all, maybe a couple of visual parts of it. But I was thinking, oh, is the army going to like immediately use this for evil? And maybe they're going to try to do good and we're going to make this ourselves and, you know, something. But yeah, it doesn't go the way I thought it would.
Right. So Sebastian decides that he's going to be the first human test subject, and they go back to the lab, and before they give him the injection, he makes this joke about Superman seeing Wonder Woman on like a roof somewhere, and he decides that he can have sex with her really quickly and she'll never know. And he flies down, he has sex with her, and he thinks he got away with it. But then Wonder Woman says, hey, what was that? And the Invisible Man says, I don't know, but my ass is killing me. And, you know, this is obviously a rape joke.
It's a double rape joke, because you think the quote-unquote joke is about raping Wonder Woman, but actually the Invisible Man is the one that gets raped in this scenario.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I remember hearing that joke. I don't remember if I heard it just from this movie or if I heard it somewhere else.
Oh, no, I had definitely heard this joke. This is like a dirty joke that, like, you know, 12-year-old boys say, or at least at my 12-year-old peers would say, when you first start saying, like, curse word jokes. Like, this is just one of those things, because it's about Superman.
But the thing is that it's not just a throwaway, because it really does give you a window into how Sebastian thinks about the world, and definitely comes into play in his character later. But he goes through the process. He becomes invisible. You see his bare ass. If anyone is looking forward to seeing Kevin Bacon's bare ass, it's in this movie. Also in Wild Things, I believe, which is another movie we will definitely do on the podcast.
Well, you also see his entire bare anatomy. I mean, I think it's a brilliant piece of animation or special effects that happens here. I mean, he does not turn invisible. Like, he doesn't snap. It's not like Star Wars when a Jedi dies. It's not a slow fade like Back to the Future. They turn invisible from the outside in, and their skin turns invisible. You see their eyeballs, and then you see their outer musculature, then their organs and their vasculature, their heart, and ultimately then their skeleton is there, and then the skeleton kind of fades into invisibility. And I think it's an absolutely brilliant scene. And also, I like the fact that Sebastian, he almost doesn't survive it. I like that. I think it adds a good amount of danger to it. Like, holy shit, if that's the invisibility, visibility part, you understand that when you touch the invisible again, like, it's probably gonna be very painful again.
It definitely looks good. It's a weird little detail to be hung up on, but the thing that I found really disturbing from this scene is, like, while he's thrashing around, the IV rips out of his arm. The thought of that always just makes me cringe. Like, that just feels like that's got to be the most painful thing. Clearly, also, turning invisible is very painful, but, you know, that's fiction. I can sort of compartmentalize that in my brain. But the IV being ripped out of the vein in somebody's arm, that just makes me shudder.
Oh, let me actually just dispel that for you right now. The IV is like this. There is a needle inside of a straw, and that whole thing, the edge of the needle, that sharp part, is used to drive the entire thing into your bloodstream. But then the needle is pulled out. There is a very, very flimsy, almost string-like consistency of plastic that's inside your vein. I guarantee you, Al, an IV being ripped out, the most painful part is probably the tape being ripped off of your hand. Maybe a central line you don't want ripped out of you, but a regular IV, I can put you, your nightmares at ease. It's like a little string that's actually inside your veins.
I didn't say I had a nightmare about it, but that is good to know. That is interesting. But like very quickly on his first night, Sebastian goes for a walk around the lab while he's invisible. And one of the other women who works there, not Linda, this woman named Sarah, he decides to take off her shirt and feel her boobs while she's sleeping.
First, the guy's staring at the woman across from his apartment. That does not make him a criminal. Second, he makes a dirty joke. That does not make him a criminal. Third, he opens a woman's blouse and squeezes her breast. Yes, folks, we have a sexual predator.
Right, this woman's asleep. And they try to bring him back, make him visible again. But for whatever reason, it doesn't work.
This revisualization scene is fantastic. It's basically the invisibility scene, but in reverse. His vasculature comes back, and then his musculature is coming back, and he's almost visible again. You can see it's Kevin Bacon, but he's not totally visible, maybe 90%. And then he goes into flatline. And then what do they do, like they always do in Hollywood? They grab the defibrillator, those pads, and they shock him, and they shock him back to life. Now, folks, this is not how defibrillators work. It is not like jumper cables on your car. That works. You can bring a dead battery back to life. What defibrillators do is when you have some kind of arrhythmia, it's going insane. It's not doing that beep, beep. It's not doing that very nice sinus rhythm. It's doing like just, you know, a script S's all over the screen over and over and over. And you say, we need a hard reset on this motherfucker. And you grab those defibrillators and you say clear and you just shock that because the heart has a battery in there, that pacemaker. And you just shock the pacemaker. It goes a little haywire for a second and maybe you reset it. That's pretty much the only case when defibrillators work. It's basically just for arrhythmias, not for flatline.
Okay. Well, we're learning a lot about science and proper medicine in this episode. But Sebastian doesn't die because they use the defib on him, not realistically, as you're saying, but also he doesn't become visible again. So now he's stuck in the lab. It's really creepy. He's freaking everybody in the lab out because Sarah is kind of sure that he grabbed her boobs and he might have watched the other woman go to the bathroom. And everyone thought Sebastian was a creep before he turned invisible. And now no one really likes the fact that he's, you know, invisible lurking around the lab. So they give him a synthetic plastic mask. Okay, that sort of makes sense. That way he can walk around and they can see him. But they put the latex on his face, and then Linda like cuts eye holes and a slit for his mouth while it's still on him and while he's invisible. I couldn't help but think that was a really stupid thing to do, assuming that he's their coworker and she still likes him, because, you know, a very slight slip and she pokes his eye out with the scissors.
Yeah, and, you know, he's not very likable to her, even though we obviously get the feeling that he still has feelings for her. And are we supposed to like Sebastian? Like, are we ever supposed to really like this guy?
I don't think so, but I will say that that's a matter of interpretation, because I was reading an interview with Paul Verhoeven about this, and he said that, in his opinion, the turning point for the character comes up in the scene we're going to talk about next, when he rapes the neighbor across the street. He said that for him, that was the turning point, although he also said that for some people who watched the movie, they were still rooting for Sebastian after that, which he thought was wrong and disturbing. But I mean, he sort of is the quote-unquote main character of the movie. So is he the hero? Is he the villain? Is he the anti-hero? I guess that's up to the viewer. In my opinion, he's very clearly the villain, I would say, almost from the get-go. I never liked the guy.
He's starting to become creepy with the invisibility serum, and they clearly made a point of telling us that the gorilla started being aggressive and angry after it took the invisibility serum, and it lends a perfect opportunity to turn possibly a real good genius guy into an aggressive, rapey asshole. But it seems from all the hints that everyone says that Sebastian always was kind of a creep, because people would be like, yeah, you know, if you had a visibility, I might do a little stuff, but oh man, Sebastian with this? Man, he's crazy and evil.
Yes, it's definitely heightened now, but he was always a prick to start. And he leaves the lab now that he has this latex mask. He goes home because he's just kind of feeling cooped up in the lab, which you could say, okay, maybe that's understandable. But then he looks across the street and he sees that beautiful neighbor again. And he's like, well, I'm invisible. I could go into her apartment and then really get to see her naked. And he does that. But then he doesn't stop there. He rapes her. Now, the last Paul Verhoeven movie we watched was Showgirls. And that movie contains a very violent, brutal rape scene. In this movie, we're spared from that, but it is still made quite clear that he rapes her. And then he just goes back to the lab and acts like nothing is wrong. They tell him that he can't leave because, you know, he left once, and as far as they know, the rest of his team, he didn't do anything wrong. Of course, that's not true, but they still say you cannot leave again. But of course, he does leave again by taking some kind of processor thing, attaching it to the video camera, which makes a video loop. Now, you've been talking a lot about what this movie gets wrong about medical procedures and stuff. I'll tell you, that's not how video cameras work. You can't just attach a motherboard to a video camera and that makes a loop. You need to make a loop on the tape or on the digital video or something, just attaching a device to it. No, that's not going to do it.
I agree with you. I thought that this hacking of the video camera was stupid, but all they had to do was have Sebastian say some line like, this is my baby. I know every single nut and bolt. I coded all of the, you know, make some kind of like reason why we think that this guy who's, you know, a genius who can make invisibility serums is also some kind of hacker. It's a weird thing he does. So Sebastian sneaks out and he wants to go spy on Linda because, you know, he's a creep. But once he spies on Linda, to his surprise, he sees that Matt is with her. And he is really pissed off. And there is this book. I don't know if you ever heard of this book. It's a Hollywood screenwriting book called Save the Cat, Al.
No, I have not heard of that.
It's something where it says the protagonist has to save a cat in the beginning of your story, and it makes you like the protagonist. Now he does what basically is the exact opposite of that. Sebastian goes to the lab, and he picks up, you know, these poor animals that have been turned invisible and are freaking out because they can't even see their own legs. He picks up a dog, and we could see in the infrared, he smashes the dog. Like, he smashes its head open.
Yeah, he picks up the dog and, like, flings it around. And then Linda realizes that Sebastian left the lab, so she goes back to the head military guy and says what happened and says, you know, we shouldn't have lied, we're sorry, but you guys need to track Sebastian down. And she's basically like ruining her own career, but she feels that it's necessary because Sebastian is so unpredictable. And in fact, Sebastian is so unpredictable that he kills this military guy before he has a chance to alert the other military people in the Pentagon.
On the bright side, the general had said, you know, Linda and Matt, your careers are over. But now that he's dead, you know, he didn't tell anyone about Sebastian being invisible, but he also didn't say anything about Linda and Matt, so their careers are fine now.
Yeah, except they have bigger problems because they get back to the lab and Sebastian has now gone full homicidal maniac and starts killing off all of the members of the scientific team one by one.
It makes sense why he has to, because the only evidence that Sebastian exists is the general, he's now dead, and there's some people in the lab. Other than that, nobody knows that Sebastian took this invisibility serum. And if he were able to escape and be invisible and run loose, he'd be the most powerful man in the world.
Exactly. That's why he's decided to kill all of his friends, colleagues, and they have these infrared goggles where they can see him, like you were mentioning earlier, but they take them off a lot. It's really stupid. Like, they're holding these goggles in their hands while they're running down the hallways looking for him. And then sometimes they'll hold them up to their eyes and then they'll put them back down again. Like, no, wear the goggles. They attach to your head. There's a strap. Wear them. Then they have like a reason why they're not going to work, because Sebastian turns up the heat.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. And you had to do something like that because the infrared goggles are such an advantage and takes away all the advantage of the invisible person. But I 100% agree with you. Why the fuck were you ever taking your goggles off, idiots? And exactly when they do, they either get killed or knocked out.
Yeah, it's stupid. Even if the air is like that temperature, wouldn't you still be able to see like the shape with the infrared goggles of a person like running through the air? I feel like they would still be better than nothing, even if it's not great.
There were a lot of things they should have done. They should have all been walking around with cans of paint. There were a lot of things they could have been doing.
They don't have paint, but Sarah, she grabs like some blood and starts splattering it everywhere, because then she'll have a footprint, which is not a terrible idea, but it doesn't stop Sebastian from killing her.
Well, it was so stupid. She's like in the corner of a room and she's throwing blood everywhere. So she's now completely cornered herself and there's blood everywhere. And there's no way Sebastian can, you know, get to her without seeing those footprints in the blood. But he was behind her the whole time and kills her.
Right. He manages to kill everyone except Matt and Linda. Matt, he like hits with a crowbar, and it's one of those things where it looks really bad, and it is really bad, but he's gonna pull through.
And he also slices him open in his abdomen, and he's got a huge wound. And what do? They duct tape his body together.
Well, that's all Linda has. I mean, he traps them in a freezer, so there's not a ton of equipment in there. She improvises.
In that case, you're absolutely right. She does duct tape it, and that's something you would do. The problem is that in the very next scene, he climbs like a 5-story ladder. Do you know how much of your abdominal muscles you're going to be using? He's going to be ripping open his chest.
I do like how Linda sort of figures out how to get out of the freezer. She uses her smarts and she uses the defibrillator machine, which is in the freezer for some reason. That's a little bit weird. But she basically creates a magnet with the machine and some wire and a handle. And she's able to use that to move the lock that Sebastian had put on the door. And then she's able to get out of the freezer and drag Matt out, who is now okay because he only had that giant gash in his stomach. Now there's duct tape on it. Duct tape fixes everything. Duct tape solves all problems. So he's okay. And Sebastian has like basically created a bomb with the centrifuge. He's put like all this acid in there and it's set to blow. And he's leaving. He's out of there. He's got the mask, which he draws eyebrows on to make it look more realistic so he can leave the lab. But he also then puts on sunglasses and a hat and a hood. So the one part of his face that you will never see is the eyebrows.
It's interesting. But the really interesting part is that we find out that invisibility gives you certain powers that I didn't think it had. Because the protagonists have escaped. They've escaped their freezer. And Sebastian's about to get out. It's a race against time. Because if Sebastian gets loose, then he's gone forever. And there's no guns in this film. They have to kind of improvise. And Elizabeth Shue, she makes a flamethrower. It's fucking awesome. She sets him on fire. And, you know, invisible or not, you know, that shit burns. And he's flailing all four limbs. And he's burning for like 10 seconds. But then he just like takes off his clothes and he just runs away, because I guess third degree burns over your entire body don't hurt because you're invisible.
Well, if you don't have skin, then you can't have your skin burn, but he is still a person. So, yeah, I don't really know. So then he's still able to attack Linda. Matt comes out of the blue. He uses the crowbar to knock him down, but then he throws the crowbar on the ground, which is the dumbest thing you can do in a movie, because then Sebastian gets up and he takes the crowbar and tries to hit them, but misses. He hits an electrical box and then gets electrocuted. So now he has been set on fire, hit with a crowbar, and electrocuted.
But he's still okay because he's invisible, I guess? All they had to do was also say that the gorilla was impervious to blah, 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 blah. They just had to give us something. But suddenly, like, he's not being able to be killed by things that generally kill human beings, visible or not, and things that seem to be hurting him. You know, it's not like he goes on fire and he's like, ha ha, I have no skin, therefore it's impervious. Or, you know, the electricity, like it goes through me because I don't conduct anymore because I'm invisible. Like, no, it's clearly hurting him. And he gets knocked in the head with a crowbar that will kill a man. At least you're going to crack that skull with a crowbar. Josh Brolin, they've shown him shirtless several times in this film. That guy has at least a six pack, possibly more in those abs.
I counted seven.
There was a seventh muscle there. He has it, and he swung at full speed right before this guy was going to kill his girlfriend. That is going to crack a skull, but no, he's fine. But that's not the worst part of this scene.
The stupidest thing that happens in this scene is then they go into the elevator shaft and they're climbing the ladder because Sebastian disabled the elevator. And then the bomb goes off, the elevator is lifted up, and Matt and Linda decide to hug the wall so that the elevator will go past them as it goes up. That is the stupidest possible thing they could do. These are brilliant scientists, mind you. Linda just came up with that whole electromagnet thing to get out of the freezer. You jump on top of the elevator. That is what you should do, because the elevator is going to go up because of the explosion and then come down because of gravity. These very smart scientists should know about gravity.
Okay, Al, I'll give you that. However, let's give them the benefit of the doubt that, you know, this is an adrenaline rush. Five of their colleagues have just been brutally murdered. You know, let's say that they got a little scared and they hugged the wall. What did they find out? They found out that, wow, you can hug the wall and it will pass you. It might scrape your shoulder a little bit, but, you know, you'll survive. Because they keep climbing the ladder and then the elevator's coming down. Why don't they just hug the wall again and let it pass them?
Well, because now the elevator is off its track cable thing and now it's going askew. So now there's no guarantee that hugging the wall will work.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I guess that's right. That's what it was.
I did have that same thought, but like, it's horrifically stupid. Not surprisingly, Sebastian was on top of the elevator. He's smarter than the other guys. He didn't forget about gravity. He grabs onto Linda's foot and she is able to hold on to the elevator cable, kick the cable attachment thing from the elevator, and he falls to his death. Presumably, you assume that he can't survive this thing. You only know that because he kind of falls in slow motion and there's a music cue that tells you that this is the real, real end of this character. After the last seven things that happened to him that should have killed him, this will be the one that kills him. And there's really not even much of like a button epilogue scene. The movie basically just ends with them walking out of the building, going to an ambulance, and then the credits start rolling. There's no extra little scene of the evidence was destroyed, but we found his body, or the project has been shut down. Like, not even that. It's just over. So now that it is over, I'm going to ask you, James, what do you think of 2000's Hollow Man? Does the movie stand the test of time?
I'm going to tell you that there were a lot of talented people in this film. You have a very talented director. You have Jerry Goldsmith, who made the music on this film. I thought he was fantastic. He's done very, very famous stuff. I mean, he's done Air Force One and L.A. Confidential, the Rambo films, Gremlins, that was him as well. And another thing that is undoubtedly a fantastic is the special effects team. This film is 20 years old. I think it's awesome. I think the special effects were beautiful. And I'm actually convinced that the people that greenlit this film were shown one of these scenes. Probably a rudimentary version of it. But just this reanimation sequence of the whole body slowly being animated. And I think it's awesome. I think the cast is good. I mean, Josh Brolin, Elizabeth Shue, Kevin Bacon. I think everyone's fine. The side characters are fine as well. There's a good love triangle here, and I don't think it's kind of like a stupid love triangle. I really thought her boyfriend, I didn't think it was going to be Josh Brolin. I thought it was going to be some random doctor or something and, like, you know, some nice guy, and he's just going to kill him. You know, I really like some of the story elements to this. But the problem is they didn't really come up with a good screenplay based on the amazing special effects that they had. And I think that's really where they went wrong. I mean, I think even in this screenplay, there's a lot of really interesting elements. I mean, I talked about it earlier. I mean, you have this idea that there's hints that the serum makes you go mad. And then, boom, I mean, you've got like your Green Goblin from Spider-Man. I mean, it's your classic thing. It's a sympathetic thing that happens to you. But we're never sympathetic to this guy. And the part where he goes out and he scares kids, it's fun. You know, if he robs some banks and if he does some stuff, I can be totally cool with it. And he lies to the army and, you know, it seems obvious, make the army the bad guy. They want to use this for their super soldiers or something, but they just don't go anywhere with that. You know, I was even thinking about it, like, this woman that he rapes was like pushed down by some invisible force. Think about what actually happens to this woman, assuming he didn't kill her, but assuming she's alive, no evidence at all. She's going to probably go insane. There's elements in this film that are intriguing, but why did they decide to make this character, like, rapey? In The Invisible Man, 1933, he becomes a homicidal maniac. He destroys a train for no reason. And, you know, he mentions he can do whatever he wants, but they don't show it. I mean, this character, Sebastian, I like when you hate a villain, but I feel like this is the perfect character that you're supposed to see fall from grace and maybe have him feel some element of guilt for what he's doing. And, you know, maybe he's, I can't take it anymore, and he sacrifices himself so that the formula is never found or something and blows up the lab. But the fact that he's a total creep and then becomes a homicidal creep, and then he's rescued by, I mean, while Elizabeth Shue and Josh Brolin are good actors, like, I'm not really rooting for anyone in this film. So the special effects are brilliant, and the score is great, and there's wonderful talent here, but they just didn't come up with a movie. So this film does not stand up. It's just a mess. What do you think, Al?
I agree. I mean, the cast is very strong. Kevin Bacon, Elizabeth Shue, Josh Brolin, these are good actors who are in a movie that is so far beneath them and their abilities. Yeah, the special effects look good, but the movie is just awful. The script is terrible. It's not interesting. It's not exciting. It's not surprising. I mean, like, was there any moment in the movie when you were, like, surprised by a plot twist? Not surprised by the characters doing something horrifically stupid or, like, a medical thing that's wrong. But, like, were there any good kind of surprises?
No, not at all. Good or bad.
It's so rote. It's so formulaic. I did see a quote from Paul Verhoeven where he said that this is a movie that he was kind of disappointed in because he said that anybody could have made it. He's like, you know, I don't think anyone else could have made RoboCop or Starship Troopers the way I made it, but any director could have made this movie. And I agree with that. I think that it's just generic. It's by the numbers. It's so painfully formulaic. And
yeah,
we just watched The Invisible Man from 1933, so that's fresh in my mind. But I thought that maybe this movie would do something a little bit more interesting, because in the 1933 movie, it starts off and he's invisible and he's already insane. And this movie, it starts off where he's visible and we're going to see his journey, but not really. We don't. We see that he's a prick and then he becomes a rapist and a murderer. And okay. I mean, in last week's episode, I was saying how it's kind of bizarre how that character says, as an invisible man, I can rob and rape and kill. And it's like, wait, why did he say rape? That's weird. And then in this movie, that's like the central tenet of this character. That's like all he wants to do.
But at least the 1933 character, we got hints that he was a good man with a wonderful woman beforehand, and it turned him crazy. But this guy's just a rapey, creepy asshole that finally, once he had the opportunity to do it, he did it.
Yeah, like, if he's just a rapist and a prick and everything, fine. But it does sort of seem like maybe you're supposed to like him a little. I don't know. I'm always going to root for Elizabeth Shue. I know I said in our Karate Kid and Adventures in Babysitting episodes how much I love her, but the whole movie, it's just supposed to be shocking. It's supposed to be scary. It's not a good thriller. It's not a good sci-fi movie. It's not really a good anything. So no, it does not stand the test of time.
You know what else I realized in this film? Elizabeth Shue should have had such a bigger career, in my opinion. You know, she just never was huge. I mean, it's just a shame she didn't become as huge as she should have been.
She's phenomenal. I absolutely love Elizabeth Shue. At some point, we will watch Leaving Las Vegas. I think I pitched it in 2020. It was like the 25th anniversary. And you were like, I don't want to be depressed right now and watch that movie, which was totally, totally fair. 2020 was depressing enough. We didn't need to watch it then. At some point, we'll go back to that one. But that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we're doing a movie that you've picked, so I'm already nervous. What's the movie we're talking about?
It's a film from 1979 called The Frisco Kid. And I guarantee you, folks, you are all fans of the main stars of this film. I'll bet you most people in the world, their top 10 films have movies with these two actors in them. So we'll see how you like The Frisco Kid next week.
All right, well, I guess I'll get some Rice-A-Roni ready. That's a dated San Francisco joke. But I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm looking forward to talking about it, because I'm always looking forward to doing these podcasts with you, James. It's always a good time. You, the listener, don't forget to subscribe. Write us a review on Apple Podcasts. That should be your New Year's resolution, that you're going to write us a review on Apple Podcasts. Do it. It takes 2 seconds. We love reading those. Talk to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.